because the foundation did not adequately document its costs and did not comply with the EPA regulations, we questioned the federal share claimed of $25,372,590. The America's Clean Water Foundation disappeared soon after the discovery of financial shenanigans. While performing the single audit for the year ended June 30, 2004, RAFFA, the foundation's accounting firm, discovered accounting irregularities and a potential embezzlement of funds. In a July 14, 2006 letter, the foundation's attorney notified EPA that the foundation was formally dissolved. The letter stated that all members of the board of directors had resigned, the foundation filed dissolution papers with the District of Columbia, and it no longer had any employees or an office location. The stated reason for the dissolution was the lack of program funding. The foundation could no longer operate effectively or respond to agency inquiries. The letter indicated that foundation records and files had been moved to a storage facility in Standardsville, Virginia, that access to the records can be arranged, and that the foundation retained its right to initiate and maintain claims. The investigation also uncovered a smelly arrangement between the foundation and the pork industry. One of the foundation's contractors, which raked in tens of millions in federal EPA grants through no-competition bids, was a firm called Validus Services, LLC, a for-profit subsidiary of the National Pork Producer Council. Agricultural journalist Alan Gubert originally broke the story of how the pork lobby collaborated with the Not-So-Clean Clean Water Foundation to set up federal environmental assessments funded through the EPA and from which they both profited. The agency gave up efforts to recover the taxpayer money squandered by the foundation. Cannon remained tight-lipped about his withdrawal. Supporters portrayed him as a victim of guilt by association. "I appreciate your interest in this," Cannon told The Hook, a Charlottesville weekly newspaper, "but I said what I wanted to say in the statement I released, and I want to leave it at that." Charles Freeman, an unintelligent choice. The directorship of the National Intelligence Council is not a position for the thin-skinned, paranoid, or ethics-compromised, or at least it shouldn't be. Somehow, however, President Obama nominated former U.S. Ambassador to Saudi Arabia Charles Freeman to the post in late February 2009. Freeman's responsibilities would include preparation of important national intelligence estimates about potential threats to our national security. Both the left and right in Washington balked at Freeman's baggage. Once again, Obama's supporters were left wondering why the Ivy League geniuses in the White House didn't see this coming. His conflicts of interest abounded. Freeman had served for 4 years on the board of the China National Offshore Oil Corp, a company owned by the Chinese Communist government. The state-owned firm has invested in Sudan and Iran. Freeman also led the Middle East Policy Council, a Washington, D.C.-based group funded by the Saudi government. Washington Times reporter Eli Lake also disclosed that Freeman chaired Projects International, a consulting firm that has worked with foreign companies and governments. To compound those ethical concerns, Freeman was a Jew basher and tyrant coddler with the Blame America axe to grind. Liberal writer Jonathan Chait called Freeman an ideological fanatic of the realist school blinded to morality. Freeman endorsed hyperbolic attacks on Zionist political influence, and wrote a leaked email obtained by the Weekly Standard that China's problem in handling the Tiananmen Square massacre was that it was too restrained. The truly unforgivable mistake of the Chinese authorities was the failure to intervene on a timely basis to nip the demonstrations in the bud, rather than, as would have been both wise and efficacious, to intervene with force when all other measures had failed to restore domestic tranquility to Beijing and other major urban centers in China. In this optic, the Politburo's response to the mob scene at Tiananmen stands as a monument to overly cautious behavior on the part of the leadership, not as an example of rash action. I do not believe it's acceptable for any country to allow the heart of its national capital to be occupied by dissidents intent on disrupting the normal functions of government, however appealing to foreigners their propaganda may be. Such folk, whether they represent a veteran's bonus army or a student uprising on behalf of the goddess of democracy, should expect to be displaced with dispatch from the ground they occupy. On the right, the editors of National Review ripped the appointment as an abject intelligence failure. "He has distinguished himself as a rabid Israel hater, who regards the Jewish state's defensive measures as the primary cause of jihadist terror. He is a shameless apologist for Saudi Arabia, where he once served as U.S. ambassador, despite its well-documented record of exporting terrorists and jihadist ideology. And he is a longtime sycophant of Beijing, where he served as Richard Nixon's interpreter during the 1971 summit and later ran the U.S. diplomatic mission. In 2002, Freeman echoed President Obama's former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright, Jr., waxing indignantly, "And what of America's lack of introspection about September 11th? Instead of asking what might have caused the attack or questioning the propriety of the national response to it, there's an ugly mood of chauvinism. Before Americans call on others to examine themselves, we should examine ourselves." Doing the vetting the Obama administration wouldn't do, critics examined the Saudi government's $1 million grant to Freeman's Middle East Policy Council. National security journalist Gabriel Schoenfeld quoted Freeman acknowledging that the group owed its endowment to the generosity of Saudi King Abdullah bin Abdulaziz. The panel also paid Freeman nearly $90,000 in 2006. Whatever else you think of the Saudis, they spare no expense in rewarding their lapdogs, syndicated columnist Rich Lowry noted. But instead of the regular vetting process, Freeman's advocate, Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair, assigned a special inspector general to probe Freeman's foreign financial ties. The White House claimed ignorance of the matter. For his part, Blair insisted on praising Freeman's inventive mind, that's one way to put it, at a Senate hearing just hours before the withdrawal was announced. On March 10, 2009, Freeman's inventive mind was on full, festering display in an open letter blasting the Israel lobby for character assassination upon his withdrawal. "I have concluded that the barrage of libelous distortions of my record would not cease upon my entry into office. The effort to smear me and destroy my credibility would instead continue. I do not believe the National Intelligence Council could function effectively while its chair was under constant attack by unscrupulous people with a passionate attachment to the views of a political faction in a foreign country. I agree to chair the NIC to strengthen it and protect it against politicization, not to introduce it to efforts by a special interest group to assert control over it through a protracted political campaign. The libels on me and their easily traceable email trails show conclusively that there is a powerful lobby determined to prevent any view other than its own from being aired, still less to factor in American understanding of trends and events in the Middle East. The tactics of the Israeli lobby plumb the depths of dishonor and indecency and include character assassination, selective misquotation, the willful distortion of the record, the fabrication of falsehoods, and an utter disregard for the truth. The aim of this lobby is control of the policy process through the exercise of a veto over the appointment of people who dispute the wisdom of its views, the substitution of political correctness for analysis, and the exclusion of any and all options for decision by Americans and our government other than those that it favors." The screed says less about Freeman than it does about the Obama administration's AWOL vetting system. Where were the watchdogs to guard against terror-friendly, conspiracy-minded kooks slipping into sensitive intelligence positions? Like so many of the other withdrawal cases that plagued the White House, Freeman's appointment never should have happened in the first place. Incompetence, inattention to detail, and apathy were common threads, running stitches, that carried through the Richardson and Daschle cases to the Kleffer ship jumping to the Treasury and EPA dropouts. The Center for Security Policy's Frank Gaffney summed up the Freeman fiasco in four words: garbage in, garbage out. This was fast becoming the epigram for the White House. And no amount of media photoshopping, airbrushing, and diversionary fluff could cover the stench. Which brings us to Michelle Obama. Behind the glamorous exterior and soft focus lens is a hardened influence peddler on par with Obama's dropouts. Lucky for the Mrs. Obama, First ladies don't require Senate confirmation. Chapter 2. Bitter Half. First Crony, Michelle Obama. Whoopi Goldberg was giddy with laughter in June 2008 as she introduced our very special guest co-host, who actually could be the next First Lady of the United States of America, Michelle Obama. After the studio audience for ABC's The View had given her a standing ovation, the honored guest said, "I have to be greeted properly. Fist bump, please," exchanging the gesture with her hostesses. The first question went to Barbara Walters, who asked about that day's New York Times story that Mrs. Obama's appearance on the show was aimed at softening her reputation. Hard-hitting questions aren't what The View is about, but the chummy treatment Michelle Obama got from Whoopi, Barbara, and the gang was hardly different than the adulatory coverage she has received from the rest of a supposedly skeptical press corps. Nothing revealed the news media's love-struck idolization of Barack Obama more than the way they constantly compared him to their favorite president, JFK, with Michelle cast in the role of the media's favorite first lady. In January 2008, shortly after Obama was endorsed by the Kennedy clan, Teddy, his son Patrick, and JFK's daughter Caroline, Helena Andrews of Politico invoked the Jacqueline Kennedy comparison. Michelle cut the faultless figure of the quintessential president's wife last Saturday in South Carolina, the president, of course, being John F. Kennedy and the wife being Jackie. CBS News gushed after the election, "Change is definitely coming to 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, as our next First Lady, Michelle Obama, is bringing a new sense of style to the White House." Obama follows in the fashion footsteps of First Ladies like Jackie Kennedy, who was known for her sophistication and elegance. The glamorous Camelot aura of the Kennedy administration was obviously what the media had in mind with this comparison, rather than more recent revelations about JFK's ties to the Chicago mob. As with her husband, however, the new First Lady's media-generated image doesn't quite match the reality of her life. Beneath the cultured pearls, sleeveless designer dresses, and false eyelashes applied by her full-time makeup artist, Michelle Robinson Obama is a hardball Chicago politico. Starstruck liberal journalists swoon over Michelle O's bare arms, but it's her bare knuckles they should be watching. Anyone who criticizes her is at risk of being labeled a racist. The First Lady long ago showed a willingness to employ accusations of racial oppression as a defense against criticism. Mrs. Obama's senior thesis at Princeton University, titled "Princeton Educated Blacks and the Black Community," bemoaned her racial otherness. The aggrieved Ivy Leaguer accused her university of pushing her down the dreaded path toward further integration and/or assimilation into a white cultural and social structure that will only allow me to remain on the periphery of society, never becoming a full participant. Rather than remaining on the periphery, however, Mrs. Obama climbed the crooked Chicago ladder on a rapid ascent to the top. She hopped from Princeton to Harvard to prestigious law firms, cushy nonprofit gigs, and an exclusive Hyde Park Manse before landing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue with the greatest of ease. While regaling campaign crowds with complaints about her burdensome education loans and unhappiness with a lily-white corporate world, she neglected to mention that it was a white male Princeton alum, Sydney and Austin corporate law partner Stephen Carlson, who went beyond the call of duty to bring her from the imagined periphery to the center of power. He gave her career advice and summer work suggestions while she was an undergrad, and then reached out to her again when she was at Harvard Law. She had a grand time as a summer associate in 1987, accepted a full-time job upon graduation, and never looked back. In the Chicago patronage culture that made Michelle Obama, the color that matters most is neither black nor white, it is green, the color of money. Mrs. Obama was literally born into the Chicago political corruptocracy. Her father, Frazier Robinson, was a volunteer precinct captain for the Democrat Party. Washington Post writer Liza Mundy called him an essential member of the powerful political machine run by Richard J. Daley, who, in addition to being mayor, was the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Central Committee, meaning he controlled both the government and the political party and could use one to do the other's bidding. Former alderman Leon Dupre bluntly told Mundy that it was overwhelmingly likely that Robinson's job at the city water department was a reward for his loyalty. The water department where Frazier Robinson worked was a renowned repository of patronage jobs. Why such little scrutiny of Michelle the Merciless, or that other Michelle, as she's known in my house, and her crony-aided rise to power? Like her husband, Mrs. Obama is quick to play the victim card when her ill-considered statements and her dealings come under scrutiny. I don't call her President Obama's bitter half for nothing. Remember when the Tennessee Republican Party ran a hard-hitting ad in spring 2008, skewering Mrs. Obama's patriotism-impaired remark at a Wisconsin campaign rally? "For the first time in my adult life, I am proud of my country." The Obamas took to ABC's Good Morning America to bemoan the low class and detestable criticisms. Obama insisted indignantly that these folks should lay off my wife. Mrs. Obama laughed softly at his side. Perhaps the self-proclaimed Southside girl chuckled because she knew how transparently ridiculous her hubby's spousal defense really was. Mrs. Obama, he argued to Glamour magazine, was an innocent bystander, untrained in the rough-and-tumble ways of political life. Senator Obama, it's infuriating, but it's not surprising because, let's face it, what happened was that the conservative press, Fox News and the National Review and columnists of every ilk, went fairly deliberately at her in a pretty systematic way and treated her as the candidate in a way that you just rarely see the Democrats try to do against the Republicans. And I've said this before, I would never have my campaign engage in a concerted effort to make Cindy McCain an issue, and I would not expect the Democratic National Committee or people who are allied with me to do it. Because essentially spouses are civilians, they didn't sign up for this. Mrs. Obama most certainly signed up for heightened public scrutiny of her public words and deeds. She signed up for it the minute she voluntarily stepped on the campaign trail to sell her husband as America's soul fixer. She signed up for it when she made herself a public spokeswoman for working mothers and chief public surrogate for her husband's legislative agenda. She signed up for it when she consciously and continuously milked liberal bitterness on the campaign trail to drum up votes for her husband. If she couldn't stand what little heat she was exposed to during the presidential election season, she should have refrained from grabbing the closest microphone to complain repeatedly about America's health care, lack of compassion, and the evil lure of corporate America.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Exposing the First Lady's crony history is vital to understanding the depth and breadth of her hubby's ethical corruption. The couple's political and financial fortunes have been intertwined since their earliest days together in Chicago. Their marital partnership is a business partnership that has profound domestic policy consequences. Like Hillary Clinton, Michelle Obama intends to play a hands-on role as a policy advocate the next 4 years, and she has filled her staff with seasoned Chicago operatives like herself with longtime big business ties and left-wing agendas. As you'll see throughout this book, the two are far from mutually exclusive. Even the most seemingly innocuous of Mrs. Obama's aides in the White House is a credentialed crony. Take the First Lady's Social Secretary, Desiree Rogers. Mrs. Obama heaped praise on her dear friend's phenomenal job of creating a people's house. Fawning profiles of Rogers focused on the aide's taste in clothes and art. But in true Obama fashion, the First Lady chose a hometown political pal who is an expert in much more than China patterns and scheduling matters. Rogers sees herself not merely as a party planner, but as the overseer of the White House strategy for events. While she pays lip service to exercising restraint in Washington, as we go through our struggle, there is a need to be prudent. Rogers defended the lavish Camelot scene that quickly became an Obama hallmark in the economically stressed first 100 days. The celebrity-filled cocktail nights and conga lines are a means to an end, she explained to National Public Radio. My belief is that we don't always get everything accomplished over a meeting table, Rogers says. Many times it's over cocktails, it's over dinner, and so the other piece to our work will be what kind of events can we create. Fittingly, Ms. Rogers' personal motto is Laissez les bons temps rouler. Let the good times roll. With her savvy fundraising skills, she helped keep Team Obama rolling in dough during the 2008 presidential campaign. According to left-wing watchdog Public Citizen, Rogers bundled more than $200,000 for Obama and contributed $28,500 to committees supporting her good friend. A Harvard MBA and former Allstate financial executive, Rogers spent 2004 to 2008 as head of People's Gas and North Shore Gas, a $1.1 billion natural gas utility in Chicago. During her tenure, the utility's parent company was sued for artificially inflating gas prices. A settlement with Illinois regulators required the firm to refund $100 million to consumers. Separate actions resulted in fines of $500,000 for a backlog of overdue meter safety inspections and $1 million for failing to properly inspect distribution pipes. In April 2009, financial disclosure forms revealed that Rogers collected more than $1 million for her work as president of two gas companies for part of 2008. Later, she earned a $350,000 salary from Allstate Financial as president of its social networking division and $150,000 in board fees from Equity Residential, a real estate investment trust in which she also holds at least $250,000 in stock. Rogers has known Mr. and Mrs. O for more than a decade. How did they meet? You can thank those Ivy League connections, the same connections that Michelle Obama griped would keep her on the periphery. Rogers' ex-husband, John W. Rogers, Jr., chief executive of multi-billion-dollar Ariel Capital Management, played basketball with Michelle O's brother, Craig Robinson, at Princeton. Mr. Rogers also served as a campaign finance bundler for Team Obama. The Rogers were among 79 top fundraisers who, according to the Washington Post, tapped their personal networks to raise at least $200,000 each. The bundlers recruited a total of more than 27,000 donors to write maximum limit checks for $2,300 each. These deep-pocketed rainmakers represent one of the endless glaring examples of Obamapocracy. In 2007, then-Senator Barack Obama boldly declared in a Chicago Tribune op-ed piece, "To set an example, in the 2008 presidential election, I am refusing to accept campaign contributions from registered federal lobbyists, political action committees, and I won't take contributions bundled by lobbyists. I'm also reporting any contributions that are bundled, whether it's from a small-town doctor or chief executive officer. If we can open up the system and pull aside the curtain of secrecy, then we might be able to start changing the way Washington works." But of course, no lobbyist money depends on the meaning of lobbyist. The Obama campaign sheepishly clarified that the policy of Obama's campaign is not to accept campaign contributions from registered federal lobbyists. He is accepting contributions from registered state lobbyists. Ah! Obama himself explained the quid pro quos of bundled donations put together by bundlers who amass campaign contributions for politicians in his column assailing this disclosure-evading campaign finance practice. "These lobbyists are delivering millions in bundled contributions to the very politicians from whom they are seeking favorable votes or legislation. It is no coincidence that the best bundlers are often granted the greatest access, and access is power in Washington." Indeed, it is no coincidence that Mrs. Obama is now using her perch in the White House to reward wheeler dealers like Desiree Rogers, who helped pave her husband's path to power and her own. And it is no coincidence that the Obamas' water carriers in Congress are fighting reasonable proposals to keep the First Lady's public policy-related meetings transparent to the public. Preemptively playing the victim card on Mrs. O's behalf, Democrat Congressman William Clay argued in a heated House debate in March 2009 that a Republican open meetings amendment would be seen by the president as an attack on his wife. Remember, in Chicago politics and in Obamaland, there are no coincidences. Valerie Jarrett, godmother, confidant, slumlord. After graduating from Princeton University and Harvard Law School, the bitterly oppressed Michelle Obama headed back to her native Chicago to join the high-powered law firm of Sidley Austin, the fifth largest in the world. There she griped about having to do the duties of a second-year associate while she was a second-year associate, demonstrating the trademark attitude of entitlement and inflated ego that led the law partner who recruited her to later describe her as perennially dissatisfied. At Sidley Austin, she mentored and dated Barack Obama. She also schmoozed an elite mover and shaker who would become the Obamas' consigliere for life. Democrat activist and real estate mogul Valerie Jarrett was a protege of Chicago Mayor Richard Daley. A member of Hyde Park's upper crust, who hobnobbed with other wealthy black families in Martha's Vineyard, Jarrett later closely consulted with her great-uncle and Clinton crony super lobbyist Vernon Jordan for campaign advice. The Obamas don't make a move without Jarrett. She has been dubbed the other side of Barack's brain and Barack's rock. In an October 2008 interview with the Chicago Tribune, President Obama said of his relationship with Jarrett, "I trust her completely." Michelle Obama shares that same reverence and devotion. I can count on someone like Valerie to take my hand and say, "You need to think about these three things," she told the New York Times. Like a mom, a big sister, I trust her implicitly. Fellow Chicago crony Rahm Emanuel said on ABC News' This Week with George Stephanopoulos, "People should know that Valerie Jarrett is, and people do know, she is a very dear friend of the president-elect and a valuable ally of his, not only prior to running for president, in his Senate life, and just personally for Michelle and Barack." Jarrett is also tied with Michelle Obama's social secretary and campaign finance bundler Desiree Rogers. Chicago Magazine reported in 2000 that they were two-thirds of a high-profile Chicago sisterhood, along with publishing heir Linda Johnson Rice, who featured Mrs. Obama on the covers of Ebony and Jet magazines, donated $18,500 to the Obama Victory Fund, and kicked in $50,000 for the presidential inauguration. Chicago reporter-publisher Laura Washington called the women politically savvy, tough-as-nails operators. After serving as Finance Committee Chair for Obama's 2004 Senate campaign, senior advisor to the presidential campaign and co-chair of the Obama-Biden Presidential Transition Team, Jarrett was named Senior Advisor and Assistant to the President for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Liaison. Whatever her title, Jarrett is the Obama's political godmother. Jarrett's father was a renowned hematologist-pathologist, her mother a child development expert. Her maternal grandfather, Robert Roshan Taylor, was the first black man to head the Chicago Housing Authority, and his father was the first black graduate of MIT, who went on to hold a top position at the Tuskegee Institute. Educated at Stanford and University of Michigan Law School, Jarrett eschewed corporate law after a stint in the 1980s and instead became immersed in the Chicago political scene. As Daley's deputy chief of staff, Jarrett met Michelle Robinson, then engaged to Barack Obama, and persuaded her to leave her private law firm for a public sector stint as Assistant Commissioner of Planning and Development. According to Obama lore, Michelle didn't take the job until Jarrett agreed to meet Barack for a two-hour grilling in July 1991. With characteristic narcissism, Mrs. Obama reportedly told Jarrett, "My fiancé wants to know who is going to be looking out for me and making sure that I thrive. Ask not what you can do for your law firm, but what your law firm can do for you." From then on, everywhere that Jarrett went, Michelle Obama was sure to go. As the New York Times admiringly put it, "Ms. Jarrett swept the young lawyers under her wing, introduced them to a wealthier and better connected Chicago than their own, and eventually secured contacts with money essential to Mr. Obama's long-shot Senate victory." As we shall see, those contacts were also essential to Michelle Obama's career. When Jarrett left Mayor Daley's office to chair the Chicago Transit Authority, Mrs. Obama trailed her and finagled a job as head of a Citizens Advisory Board. When Daley promoted Jarrett to head the Department of Planning and Development, Obama, with no expertise or training in planning or development, followed her again. Jarrett served on numerous boards, including a prestigious position as chairman of the Board of Trustees of the University of Chicago Medical Center. She began serving on the board in 1996, ascended to vice chair in 2002, and took the helm as chair in 2006. Jarrett was also vice chair of the Board of Trustees at the University of Chicago, which she first joined in 2001. It is no coincidence that Mrs. Obama soon found herself smack dab in the middle of the university, corporate, community organizing nexus forged by Jarrett. What fawning social magazine profiles and fashion photo spreads of Jarrett leave out is the abominable history of her failures and neglect as a developer and manager of low-income housing. Jarrett's official White House biography proclaims that she became the president and chief executive officer of the Habitat Company on January 31, 2007. She had served as executive vice president of Habitat for 12 years. You will not, however, find pictures on the White House website of the dilapidated Grove Park Plaza apartment complex that Jarrett's Habitat Company oversaw. Located just south of the University of Chicago, the federal Section 8 residential development had been built in the 1960s to address affordable housing demands. Today, the Grove Park units are virtually uninhabitable and facing demolition. Three cheers for community organizing, eh? In an uncommonly hard-hitting investigative piece, the Boston Globe's Binyamin Applebaum blew the whistle on the rodent-infested, sewage-clogged Chicago slums run by the Obama's most trusted confidant. Jarrett refused to answer any questions about Grove Park, citing what she called a continuing duty to Habitat's former business partners. A continuing duty, presumably, to whitewash the inconvenient truth about the failed public-private partnerships the Obamas continued to promote in the White House. They are rapidly displacing poor people, and these companies are profiting from this displacement, said Matt Ginsburg-Jekyll of Southside Together Organizing for Power, a community group that seeks to help tenants stay in the same neighborhoods. The same exact people who ran these places into the ground, the private companies paid to build and manage the city's affordable housing, now are profiting by redeveloping them. In 2006, while Valerie Jarrett was executive vice president of Grove Park's management firm, Habitat Company, federal inspectors graded the condition of the complex a bottom-of-the-barrel 11 on a 100-point scale. Another Habitat mismanaged property called Lawndale Restoration was so run down that city officials urged the federal government to take over the complex. Jamie Calvin, a veteran Chicago housing activist, told the Boston Globe about Barack Obama, "I hope there's not much predictive value in his history and in his involvement with that community." Calvin's hopes will likely be dashed. As Chicago goes, so goes the nation. Obama has made a career of rewarding failure, and no amount of overhyped hope will change that. He sponsored a plethora of bills in the state Senate benefiting affordable housing developers. In February 2009, he unveiled a plan to set up a $1 billion housing trust fund to rehabilitate housing in the nation's poorest neighborhoods. Trust fund? Try slush fund. Bottomless pit, an eternal stimulus for the real estate moguls posing as saviors of urban America. In one of those endless Chicago coincidences, Grove Park Plaza apartments, now targeted for demolition as a result of years of neglect by Obama's developer friends, sits in the shadows of the proposed site of the city's 2016 Olympic Stadium. Valerie Jarrett is vice chair of Chicago's Olympics Committee. Mrs. O screws the poor. Speaking of uncanny timing, it's no coincidence that Mrs. Obama found herself named to another University of Chicago Medical Center post, executive director of community affairs, the year her friend and mentor, Valerie Jarrett, became vice chair of the Medical Center's Board of Trustees. Nor is it a coincidence that Mrs. Obama found herself promoted in 2005 after her husband won his U.S. Senate race with Jarrett's invaluable aid. As vice president for community and external affairs and head of the Business Diversity Program, her annual salary nearly tripled, from $122,000 in 2004 to $317,000 in 2005. Even after she went on to leave in 2007 to help her husband campaign, the hospital paid Mrs. Obama $62,709 in 2008, prompting one skeptic to ask, "We know this is Chicago, but isn't $63,000 quite a lot for a no-show job?" Hospital officials asserted that Mrs. Obama was worth her weight in gold, singling out her special relationship with and her new level of compassion for the city's poor. But it was undoubtedly her relationships with her husband and political godmother that held far greater value. "She just has a way about her, a real kindness," gushed the hospital's general counsel, Susan Scher. But Scher is no disinterested observer. Her personal friendship with Mrs. Obama began years ago when the women worked together at Chicago City Hall. Scher headed up Mayor Daley's legal department when Michelle Oh came on board. In January 2009, Scher was tapped to serve as White House Associate Counsel. The high-paying community affairs post was another make-work job no one else at the university needed to do until Michelle Obama came along, and it was a job no one else needed to fill after she left. In January 2009, Mrs. Obama's indispensable job was eliminated as part of a massive restructuring to cut annual budget costs by 7%. Naturally, Mrs. Obama's remnant duties were taken over by another old pal. Dr. Eric Whitaker, vice president of the University of Chicago Medical Center and an Obama basketball buddy from their Harvard grad student days. Whitaker previously served as director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Obama enthusiastically recommended him for that job. And mother of all coincidences, you'll never guess to whom Obama made the recommendation. Obama, then an Illinois state senator, gave a glowing reference for Whitaker to Tony Rezko, the now convicted political fixer who helped Governor Blagojevich find people to run state agencies. Blagojevich hired Whitaker to be the state's public health director. Obama has said that's the only time he can recall talking to Rezko, who was a major campaign fundraiser for him and for Blagojevich, about getting anyone a state job. Somebody who I do remember talking directly to Tony about was Dr. Eric Whitaker, Obama told the Sun-Times in March. He and I played basketball together when he was getting his master's in public health at Harvard while I was in law school there. He had expressed an interest in that job. I did contact Tony, or Tony contacted me, and I gave him a glowing recommendation because I thought he was outstanding. Outstanding? Well, his ability to escape scrutiny and accountability for his sleazy ties to Rezko certainly is outstanding. Rezko pulled the strings at the Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board, overseeing medical construction projects. Dr. Whitaker sat as the stooge in charge of the board's budget. Rezko and his cronies controlled the board, which they used to solicit kickbacks and payoffs, according to testimony at Rezko's trial, the Chicago Tribune reported. Rezko is in jail. Whitaker remains the Obama's close confidant. Crony out, crony in. Unfortunately, for many of Chicago's poor, Mrs. Obama didn't depart until after she helped engineer a rather unprogressive and unkind plan to dump low-income patients with non-urgent complaints from the medical center. Like the unfortunate residents of Valerie Jarrett's slums, the unfortunate patients at Michelle Obama's University of Chicago Medical Center got to see the real meaning of Chicago liberal compassion. Under the Orwellian banner of an urban health initiative, Mrs. Obama sold the scheme to outsource low-income care to other facilities as a way to dramatically improve health care for thousands of Southside residents. The program guaranteed free shuttle rides to and from the outside clinics. It was old-fashioned cost-cutting and favor trading repackaged as minority aid. Clearing out the poor freed up room for insured, i.e. more lucrative patients. If a Republican had proposed the very same program and recruited black civic leaders to front it, Michelle Obama and her grievance-mongering friends would be screaming racism at the top of their lungs. To ensure community support, Michelle Obama and others in late 2006 recommended that the hospital hire the firm of David Axelrod, who a few months later became the chief strategist for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. Axelrod's firm recommended an aggressive promotional effort modeled on a political campaign, appoint a campaign manager, conduct focus groups, target messages to specific constituencies, then recruit religious leaders and other third-party validators. They in turn would write and submit opinion pieces to Chicago publications. The Medical Center's initiative provides a window into the close relationship between the Obamas, their associates at the University of Chicago, and Axelrod, the strategist most central to Barack Obama's rise. Some healthcare experts saw through Mrs. Obama and her public relations man, David Axelrod. Yes, the same David Axelrod who is now Mr. Obama's senior advisor at the White House. The patient dumping scheme was as transparent as Scotch tape. The University of Chicago Medical Center hired Axelrod's public relations firm, ASK Public Strategies, to promote Mrs. Obama's urban health initiative. Axelrod had the blessing of Valerie Jarrett. His great contribution, rebranding. Axelrod's firm recommended renaming the initiative after internal and external respondents expressed the opinion that the word urban is code for black or black and poor. Based on the research, consideration should be given to rebranding the initiative. Axelrod and the Obama campaign refused to disclose to the Washington Post how much his firm received for its genius rebranding services. No amount of repackaging could get around these bottom-line facts determined by the Post. As a hospital with nonprofit tax status, the University of Chicago Medical Center receives special tax breaks for providing charity care. It spent a measly $10 million on charity care for the poor in fiscal 2007 when Mrs. Obama was employed there, 1.3% of its total hospital expenses, according to an analysis performed for the Washington Post by the bipartisan nonprofit Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. That is below the 2.1% average for nonprofit hospitals in Cook County. Prominent Southside physician Quentin Young called the finding shameful. They are arguably, if not defrauding, then at least taking advantage of a public subsidy. In February 2009, outrage in the community Mrs. Obama was supposedly so in tune with exploded after a young boy covered by Medicaid was turned away from the University of Chicago Medical Center. Dontay Adams' mother, Angela, had sought emergency treatment for him after a pit bull tore off his upper lip. Mrs. Obama's hospital gave the boy a tetanus shot, antibiotics, and Tylenol, and shoved him out the door. The mother and son took an hour-long bus ride to another hospital for surgery. I'll guarantee you this, you'll never see the Adams family featured at an Obama policy summit or seated next to the First Lady at a joint session of Congress to illustrate the failures of the healthcare system. The Chicago Tribune reported that Mrs. Obama's hospital was one of the only hospitals in the country that decreased its contribution to caring for uninsured patients from 2006 to 2007. New level of compassion, indeed. Following the Adams incident, the American College of Emergency Physicians, ACEP, blasted Mrs. Obama and Mr. Axelrod's grand plan. The group released a statement expressing grave concerns that the University of Chicago's policy toward emergency patients is dangerously close to patient dumping, a practice made illegal by the Emergency Medical Labor and Treatment Act, EMTALA, and reflected in an effort to cherry-pick wealthy patients over poor. Favoring the wealthy over the poor while posing as guardians of the downtrodden? Hey, it's the Chicago way. Just ask the tenants in Valerie Jarrett's tax-subsidized slums. The shady business of Michelle Obama's nonprofit hospital may not have garnered widespread national interest, but someone in the U.S. Senate was paying attention. In August 2008, Senate Finance Committee Minority Ranking Member Republican Charles Grassley of Iowa pressed Mrs. Obama's employer for more information about its glaringly obvious patronage positions and the troubling patient dumping scheme. Senator Grassley has investigated the lack of adequate charity care and financial accountability at tax-exempt medical institutions for years. Nonprofit hospitals receive billions in tax benefits at the local, state, and federal levels in exchange for providing community benefit to earn the tax-exempt status. Yet many of those institutions routinely deny uninsured patients charitable care. We need to get a better handle on how nonprofit hospitals are fulfilling their requirement to serve the community in exchange for the generous tax breaks they receive, Senator Grassley concluded in April 2007 after congressional hearings found a lack of monitoring and standards. This is especially important as policymakers talk about helping the uninsured. Senator Grassley pressed the University of Chicago Medical Center, UCMC, with pointed questions concerning the Urban Health Initiative, another related Southside Health Collaborative program created by Mrs. Obama and funded with a federal grant in 2005, and Mrs. Obama's position, among the requests for information he made in his 11-page August 29, 2008 letter. Please describe each of these programs, including their history, mission, accomplishments, and revenues and losses since inception, as well as the reduction in emergency room visits resulting from these programs. Provide minutes of board or other executive meetings documenting the decision to launch these programs. Describe how UCMC funds these programs. Describe UCMC's marketing and outreach efforts for these programs. And regarding Mrs. Obama's position as Vice President of Community and External Relations, describe the hiring and selection process for this position, including when the position was created, whether the vacancy was publicly announced, and the criteria for selection. The hospital's response was due last fall. To date, it remains under review and unavailable for public consumption, and that's the way Illinois Democrats would like to keep it. The Senate's number two Democrat, Dick Durbin, bristled at Senator Grassley's pointed questions. After Senator Grassley expressed concern that the medical center was culling the least profitable patients from its emergency room and losing sight of the public service that comes with tax-exempt status, Durbin huffed in September 2008, "The fact that Senator Grassley is questioning the work of the University of Chicago Medical Center, especially those programs aimed at reducing emergency department overcrowding and promoting preventive health, is troubling and shows that he simply doesn't understand the problems facing our hospitals today. To the contrary, Senator Grassley seems to understand the racket all too well. Doctoring the bidding process. In his request for information from the University of Chicago Medical Center, Senator Grassley also raised the issue of the hospital's policy governing political activity, given its numerous ties to the Obamas, its policy regarding management salaries, its criteria for hiring and compensating public relations firms, and its process for selecting contractors. One of those contractors was businessman Robert Blackwell Sr., who owned an information technology firm, Blackwell Consulting Services. After Mrs. Obama received her promotion at the University of Chicago Medical Center, the hospital made unprecedented changes to its regular bidding process in order to include Blackwell in a competition to upgrade the center's internal computer network. Lo and behold, Blackwell Consulting won the contract and received a whopping $600,000 plus for its work. The university touted Mrs. Obama's minority vendor expansion as evidence of her neighborhood outreach accomplishments. But Blackwell wasn't any ordinary minority business owner in need of a leg up. Coincidentally, Chicago style, Blackwell Sr. had served on a local literacy group board with Mrs. Obama for years. Coincidentally, Chicago style, Blackwell Sr. is a longtime friend of Barack Obama. Coincidentally, Chicago style, Blackwell Sr. and his namesake son had bailed out Barack Obama during hard times after his failed 2000 congressional campaign. At the time, Obama was earning less than $58,000 a year as a state senator. His total income from practicing law that year, zero. In 2001, his fortune took a turn for the better. He drummed up nearly $99,000 in lawyer's fees, $80,000 of it from the Blackwells. The Blackwell family, owners of the largest minority-owned consultancy in Chicago, had hired Obama to do legal work for the son's tech business, Electronic Knowledge Interchange, EKI, on an $8,000 per month retainer. In 2002, the state senator reported $34,000 plus from legal services and speeches. Of that, $32,000 came from EKI, a relationship that ended when Obama set his sights on the U.S. Senate. Coincidentally, Chicago style, Obama had lobbied the Illinois legislature to give another Blackwell-owned business, Killerspin, a tourism promotion grant worth $50,000. The elder Blackwell son, Robert Jr., owned the table tennis manufacturer and event producer and worked with longtime Obama aide Dan Shulman. The grant subsidized ping pong tournaments at the University of Illinois Chicago. Coincidentally, Chicago style, Blackwell Jr. was one of Team Obama's top campaign financiers and a transition team member for former corruptocrat governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. Hospital officials vigorously denied any favoritism in the hospital contract award, but Blackwell Sr. himself admitted that the circumstances surrounding the work were really fuzzy. Besides, he explained to the Washington Post, Michelle Obama's diversity program was critical because minorities don't always enjoy the informal social connections available to others. Some minorities may not enjoy those informal social connections, but the millionaire Blackwells certainly did. Healthcare analyst David Catrone points out a major disparity in what Blackwell's company was paid versus the normal market price for similar services. It doesn't help appearances, Catrone noted, that the going rate for intranet upgrades rarely exceeds 10% of what Blackwell Consulting was evidently paid for the project in question. Moreover, Catrone observed, the preferential treatment actually put the hospital's status as a Medicare and Medicaid provider in jeopardy. Ironically, the Blackwell Consulting deal could have more lasting consequences for the University of Chicago Medical Center than for Michelle or Barack Obama. For a hospital, particularly one with UCMC's history, the appearance of impropriety associated with such a transaction has far more serious implications than it would for a garden variety corporation. Even if the bidding process broke no state or federal ethics statutes, it could well have violated the conditions of participation stipulated by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS. CMS conditions of participation, COP, are standards to which healthcare providers must adhere in order to receive payment for services rendered to Medicare and Medicaid patients. The most basic COP for hospitals is to remain in good standing with the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, JCAHO, which imposes stringent conflict of interest rules requiring a hospital to vet the relationships of medical staff, directors, and upper management to ensure that its mission and responsibility to the clients and community it serves is not harmed by any professional ownership, contractual, or other relationship. According to the financial reports released pursuant to its bond obligations, audits conducted in 2000 and 2001 found UCMC wanting. CMS notified the corporation that it is not in compliance with certain of the Medicare conditions of participation for hospitals. UCMC still participates in the Medicare and Medicaid programs, which suggests that the hospital eventually cleared up its COP deficiencies, but another unsatisfactory CMS audit could well be disastrous. As the financial reports mentioned above dryly phrase it, approximately 28.8% and 24.8% of the gross payment revenues of the corporation were derived from Medicare and Medicaid patients, respectively. As a result, any termination from the Medicare and Medicaid programs would adversely affect the corporation's financial position. Of course, such a termination is not bloody likely, with the Obamas running the healthcare show from the White House now. Pay for play, play for pay. It's the Protection Racketeer's Code. Earmarks and Edifice Complex. In 2005, Barack Obama nearly tripled the amount of federal earmarks flowing to his wife's employer to over $310,000. In 2008, United States Senator Barack Obama raised eyebrows even further after disclosing his $1 million request for federal earmark money to help pay for the construction of a new hospital pavilion at his wife's place of work. When asked by the Chicago Tribune about the inherent impropriety of his water carrying for Mrs. Obama's employer, the agent of Hope and Change shrugged, "I don't think that I was obligated to recuse myself from anything related to the university. When it comes to earmarks, because of those concerns, it's probably something that should have been passed on to Democrat Senator Dick Durbin, and I think probably something that slipped through the cracks. It did not come through us, through me or Michelle, and Michelle has been very careful about staying separate and apart from any government work. But you could make a good argument that this is something that slipped through our cracks, through our screening system." Note the passivity and the pass-the-buck diffidence with which Obama met the question. It should have been passed on to someone else. It slipped through the cracks. It was the screener's fault. But most importantly, "I don't think that I was obligated to recuse myself." Spoken like the faux reformer he has always been and will continue to be during his presidency. Corporate perks for me, but not for thee. Two-facedness is a trademark of the Obama power couple. While she profited handsomely from her crony corporate ties, Mrs. Obama earned the adoration of liberal women, the indulgent press, and capitalism bashers across the country by ostentatiously abandoning the corporate life for motherhood, public service, and devotion to her husband's ambition. "I wanted to have a career motivated by passion and not just money," she told the New York Times. Time magazine marveled at how this tough, razor-smart Chicago native had to sacrifice many of her own career ambitions along the way. The Washington Post quoted her best friend forever, Valerie Jarrett, lamenting her protege's decision to step down from the University of Chicago Medical Center job in 2007. "It's a sacrifice for her to give that up." Vanity Fair reported that Mrs. Obama sighed and rolled her eyes as she recounted making the family decision to enter the presidential race. "Before I signed on, I had to know in my mind and my heart, how is this going to work for me, and would I be okay with that? He wouldn't have done this if he didn't feel confident that I felt good about it, because it is a huge sacrifice. The pressure and stress on the family isn't new, but we entered this thing knowing it was going to be really, really hard." Once again, power-enabling Jarrett is quoted without a hint of irony extolling poor Michelle's hardships. "She was willing to walk away from a huge salary potential and all the trappings of power that go along with it." The great goddess of sacrifice shared her distastes and complaints about her financial and professional plights, repeatedly on the campaign trail, moaning about her college debts here, sighing about the constant struggle to balance home and work life there. In Zanesville, Ohio, in February 2008, she complained to working women at a child care center about the Ivy League career track. Mrs. Obama made a special effort to bash those who pursue corporate law and hedge fund management. Bear in mind, the median income for female workers in Zanesville and the surrounding county last year was $20,142, according to Professor Ralph Ryland, and nearly a quarter of the city's population lives below the poverty line. Not exactly an audience at risk of jumping en masse into corporate law or hedge fund management. But the tin-eared Mrs. Obama is an incurable kvetch. Moreover, the remarks and visit struck many as opportunistic pretexts for her own therapy and passive-aggressive attack on rival Hillary Clinton, corporate law, and her daughter Chelsea, hedge fund management employee. Reporter Byron York recounted the grievance fest. The salaries don't keep up with the cost of paying off the debt, so you're in your 40s, still paying off your debt at a time when you have to save for your kids, she says. Barack and I were in that position, she continues. The only reason we're not in that position is that Barack wrote 2 best-selling books. It was like Jack and his magic beans. But up until a few years ago, we were struggling to figure out how we would save for our kids. A former attorney with the White Chew Chicago firm of Sidley & Austin, Obama explains that she and her husband made the choice to give up lucrative jobs in favor of community service. We left corporate America, which is a lot of what we're asking young people to do, she tells the women. Don't go into corporate America, you know, become teachers, work for the community. Be social workers, be a nurse. Those are the careers that we need, and we're encouraging our young people to do that. But if you make that choice, as we did, to move out of the money-making industry into the helping industry, then your salaries respond. Don't go into corporate America? Easy for you to say, sister. Mrs. O parlayed her brief corporate stint into a cascading series of ever more lucrative positions and promotions in the helping industry. In turn, her hospital gig paid off sweetly thanks to the synergistic relationships she and her husband had with other corporate and political cronies. Here is a stark graph of Michelle Obama's sacrifice while working for the helping industry with a little help from hubby. While she played the martyrific about leaving the business world, Mrs. O was quite happy to serve on a plethora of community and corporate boards that pumped up her income to $500,000 in 2007. Boo freaking who. Despite her great sacrifices, the Obamas were able to afford pricey 5-figure private school tuition for both of their daughters and 4-day-a-week personal training sessions for long-suffering mom. Feigning modesty, she downplayed her hefty contribution as breadwinner and filler of the family coffers. Me? No. Barack had like 4 jobs always, she laughs. No, really. Barack's a hustler. I shouldn't say hustler, but he's a humper in terms of work. The lady doth protest too much. In June 2005, a few months after her husband was elected to the United States Senate, Mrs. Obama hustled a seat on the corporate board of directors of Treehouse Foods, Incorporated. The food processing company is a leader in supplying high-quality products and services to the private label and food service industries, including pickles, non-dairy creamer, and other items. The chairman of the board, Sam K. Reed, was a top executive at Kellogg and Keebler Foods. Other board members had decades of impressive business experience in packaging, food services, financial services, and corporate management. Mrs. Obama had her law degree, community service, and her husband's last name. In fact, she took the position for exactly the opposite reason regular executives get on such boards. Instead of assuming the job to share corporate expertise and experience, she took the seat to acquire what she did not have. Reporting in spring 2007 on her re-election to the board, the UK Telegraph said that she took the position to gain experience in the private sector. The company put her on its audit and nominating and corporate governance committees. For her on-the-job training and the privilege of putting her name and face on the literature, the company forked over $45,000 in 2005 and $51,200 in 2006, as well as 7,500 Treehouse stock options worth more than $72,000 for each year. Must have been really, really hard for Mrs. Obama to pocket such easy cash for such little work without laughing all the way to the bank. The corporation bashing Mrs. Obama would have continued collecting her corporate treehouse money for nothing if it hadn't been for her husband's pesky pledge to pander to big labor and swear off Walmart. The retail giant, you see, happens to be Treehouse's biggest customer, and Walmart is to big labor as sunshine is to Dracula. In May 2007, Obama told AFL-CIO workers in Trenton, New Jersey, that Walmart was dead to him. "I won't shop there," he pledged with an eye toward embarrassing chief rival Hillary Clinton, who had served on Walmart's board from 1986 to 1992. The AFL-CIO has waged relentless attacks on Walmart, dubbing it the poster store for greed. That, by extension, would make Mrs. Obama, all too happy recipient of a Walmart-dependent compensation package worth more than $100,000 in 2008, according to Securities and Exchange Commission records, a poster child for ancillary avarice. Once again, Barack Obama took a diffident, passive view of the glaring conflict of interests his wife's professional position posed. In November 2006, he told the left-wing WakeUpWalmart.com organization that there was a moral responsibility to stand up and fight the company and to force them to examine their own corporate values and what their policies and approaches are to their workers and how they are going to be good corporate citizens.